Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, work out, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar, winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we just sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org and check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest had a pretty eventful race at the Ironman 70.3 World Championships in Nice, France. His name is Rick Steele. Rick, how the heck you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you, Bob?
I am wonderful. So before we get into what happened on race day, which is pretty unbelievable, you grew up in Virginia, and you're one of those guys who just started working young, right? You're unloading trucks when you're 13 years old?
Yeah. Yeah, I decided pretty early I wanted to be an entrepreneur, you know, make my own way. So, yeah, mowing lawns, unloading trucks, doing whatever I could to make money for myself. So, yeah.
And so then you're the founder and CMO of Select Blinds. And talk a little bit about creating your own company. How old were you and what had you done before you created your own company?
Yeah, so, Blinds originated from this long process of starting on eBay, selling Beanie Babies. This was at the, 97, 98 years, the beginning of e-commerce on the internet.
Yeah.
That parlaying to an online mortgage company that we exited in 2003 and then started Blinds. And it was just a very organic, kind of a lot of entrepreneurial story that they'll resonate with that, not a ton of experience in blinds. You're looking for that next challenge, and then blinds shows up. You need to buy blinds, and which I did at the time. We had a newborn that was where she wasn't sleeping.
Yeah.
The sun came up at 5 a.m., so I decided to just, to get a quote for blinds. They cost too much, and I said, hey, that's not the way this should go down. Let's build a blinds company. So in 2003, we started Select Blinds as one of the first direct-to-consumer companies selling on the internet, and we've been doing this for 16 years. We love it.
I was going to say, so you're talking 2003. There weren't a lot of people selling direct at that point.
No, I don't think the term direct-to-consumer, I don't think even existed then.
That is, and also at that time, just people doing things online was fairly new as well. How did you navigate through all of that to create the success you've created?
I'll say that we got to cut our teeth in finance, with mortgage. So for 4 years, we were in one of the most competitive online arenas, which is finance. So you had to be good at what you did to survive, and we did that just barely, well enough to survive. But in the scope of what it took to actually understand what it was going to take to start a blinds company and be successful at it, I believe, we had a little bit of a gift in those 4 years being online and in finance. It was actually, we felt easier than building a mortgage company online, building this direct-to-consumer company. So, maybe a little bit of luck there that we did it early enough and, have a little bit of first adopter privilege there. But, of course, anything is, it's not easy. The easy things in life.
No, yeah.
Don't always yield big results.
Were you always an endurance guy as well, or were you more of a ball sport guy growing up?
I was a ball sport guy growing up, and then, 20s, late 20s come along, you get fat.
Yep.
And happy, and then one of the things I love about being a business owner is it allows me the time to do triathlon, which I've become completely addicted to.
But you're also, you do a bunch of adventure stuff, you're a golfer, but triathlon has become number one for you?
100%, yeah. It's I love it because the challenge of being, I'm a self-quantified individual anyway, so I'm always looking to improve my relationship with my wife and my kids and my business. Commands so much time to be good at it that it challenges the whole you know, the whole spectrum of your life. And that's really what I love about it, just the data and the challenge of, you know, working the numbers to get better. I believe that's what really made me fall in love with the sport. And plus, I got my butt kicked at Ironman Arizona a couple years ago because I somehow thought 5 hours, you could run, you could do an Ironman with 5 hours training a week. And that wasn't the case.
That's plenty. So what, was that your first Ironman experience?
It was. Ironman Arizona 2017 was the first, yeah.
And it kicked your ass.
It killed me. Like, it was, I'll never forget. I, you know, in the years leading up to that, I had done, you know, World's Toughest Mudder, done, you know, Navy SEAL experiences where you get your butt kicked for 53 straight hours with no sleep. And I went into it so cocky, thinking, I'm going to crush this. Guys on bicycles running. I mean, oh my God, how they're babies.
They're wearing Lycra. What's the big deal?
Right, exactly. I mean, you're riding a bike at 20 miles an hour for 112 miles. Who can, you know? And I didn't understand the load and the training volume, you know, that it took to really get good at that. And so, you know, I went on and did Ironman, and it completely crushed me. I said, you know, at the end of the event, I'll never do one of these ever again. And then signed up for Ironman Arizona the very next day and hired Ryan Bolton to be my coach.
You're a smart guy.
Best decision I've ever made.
I go back a long way when Ryan was an athlete and did some photo shoots with him. He made the Olympic team into the first ever Olympic triathlon team from the U.S. And have been following his career, obviously, just the people he coaches. He coaches elite athletes and age group athletes. How did you connect with Ryan, and what did he bring to the table for you?
I you know, for Ironman Arizona 2017, I'd hired a fake coach. I don't say that disrespectfully. I just say that it's like, I think there's, you know, maybe a little bit of, you know, people say that they can train, and just that facade of saying that you could train 5 hours a week to do Ironman is probably, you know, you could do it, but I don't know if you're going to be happy with yourself.
No.
So I had a friend that worked with him, and he told me all along the time, he's like, Rick, this guy's the real deal. First ever U.S. triathlete. And took this guy from being not an athlete at all to really competing on a high level in just a year. So after that experience at Ironman Arizona, you know, I called my buddy up and I said, what was that guy's name again?
Yeah.
He gave me Ryan. You know, it was like love at first sight. We, you know, became actually very fast friends. And, you know, there's just something to be said about the legitimacy of having a great coach that's looking at your numbers, that's pushing you and telling you that you dogged that workout, but then also giving you praise and lifting you up when you crushed one. And that's who Ryan is. And it's just been such a great, great partnership for the last couple of years now.
What's fascinating to me is I go back a long way with, you know, Joe DeSena, who started Spartan Race. You've been in Spartan World Championships 8 times, Tough Mudder, 2 times World's Toughest Mudder competition. And you're right in thinking, if I can do that, how tough can this triathlon thing be? Talk a little bit about, because those are really brutal events that you were doing. And what was it about those events that didn't quite carry, you didn't maybe have to do the same type of training for those type of events that you do for Ironman? The consistency is more important?
Yeah, it was. You know, I think that became a little bit of a novelty for me. I think, you know, I've done a lot of Tough Mudders. I've done World's Toughest Mudder a few times, and that's definitely a challenging event to do that for 24 straight hours.
Yeah.
But it definitely does not require the load of training that becoming which I'm still learning. Bob, it's like I used to have this belief, you know, even like a year and a half ago, I would put times out there and I would say, I'm going to go qualify for Kona next year at this race. And now I just have given myself time to realize that it takes longer because that endurance body takes so much time to build. And now I can see the gains coming. They come slow, but getting those gains are very, it's very helpful to see it in the training peaks and all the data, right? So, you know, I just think it's the amount of training that it requires. And, you know, there's something special about going completely horizontal to then getting on a bike for 112 miles and then, you know, in that position, then going to an upright running position. You know, they're different loads on the body, and when you stack them all together, it's just, it's something you can't appreciate until you get in it, that, you know, the stress it puts on the body and the type of training it requires to be good at it.
How much did you improve from the first Ironman to the second Ironman?
So we went from 1349 to 1055 last year, and yeah, it was a big difference.
Yeah, right? A little bit.
Yeah, and then we have a goal of sub 10. We're gonna try to do 940 or 950 this year in Arizona. So that's that'll get me close, right? You know, that'll get me close to Kona. So we'll see.
Kona's the goal, obviously.
It is, yeah. Kona's definitely the goal. I think if you've spent any time at all in the sport of Ironman, more than a couple, if you're so sadistic to have put yourself through more than one Ironman, I think probably you have to be looking at Kona, right?
Saying, exactly.
I'd love to get there someday.
So you qualified for Nice.
Qualified for Nice. I went to, you know, the swim is my worst event. I'm okay at it, but I've only been swimming for a couple years. So I went from being this athlete that couldn't swim the length of the pool 2 years ago without being gassed at the end of each length of the pool. And I thought like a 3,000 meter swim worked like this. You would swim 25 meters and then you would take a minute's break to get your breath and then you would swim another 25. So then that 3,000 meters on your watch looks like you did it in, 48 minutes, but you really did it in 2.5 hours. But,
yeah.
But it's, so it is, I don't know. I went out to it was Eagle Man this year.
Yeah.
They canceled the swim. I got this big smile on my face and I was like, it's time. Cause we're going to, time trial start the bike and like you have no excuse at all. So I just went out and rode the fastest I've ever rode, put the fastest half marathon down. And then, after I blacked out and woke up at the award ceremony, they called my name for world championships. So it was it was very interesting.
So you go to Nice, and for people who don't know, the 70.3 Worlds move year after year after year. So this year, last year was South Africa, this year is Nice, next year is New Zealand, and they divide the days up. So one day is all the women, next day is all the men, but it's the best people on the planet who are racing that. And then there was close to 6,000 athletes total. And the bike course in Nice, 56 miles, 4,500 feet of climbing, and it's the downhill was going to take people, the top people is going to take an hour. Average person is going to be like an hour and a half. Have you ever, you haven't been in the sport that long, but have you ever seen a bike course like that?
No. I mean, I try to train on hills out here in Arizona, and wherever I go, I take my bike and try to find where the hills are, but I've never had, a climb of 4,500 feet where it was like the first half was all uphill, the second half was pretty much all downhill. Never had that.
Okay, so you get out of the water, which obviously you were very happy about, and now you're what, 25 miles or so into the ride, and you're on the last climb?
We're on the last climb. The last, pretty much, I think there's another climb as you get near the middle of the bottom, but it's a smaller climb.
Yeah.
But I'm on the last climb, and we're like, thank God it's over. at that point, actually, I believe I've already completed Ironman because it's like, it's now just kind of hammering down, pushing watts down the hill, go really fast, which I love, and then, go into my bread and butter, which is the run. So it was, relieving to have climbed, really that last big hill.
And you see a bike in the middle of the road that's totally just beat up. And there's a 90% hairpin turn. Right away, obviously, there's a bike there and there's not a person on it.
Yeah.
You realize someone was in danger.
Yeah, so, we came over exactly. We were on this big downhill, kind of straight, and then get to these sweeping turns. You carried a lot of speed into those, and then, the slowdown signs are everywhere, but you get to this one turn, and me and another guy kind of showed up at the same time. And, there's a bike in the middle of the road. It's, it's obviously been knocked over. You could see its aero bars were knocked off to the side. Its bottle was off. It's basically shredded, and it's in the middle of the road. So the middle of the road wasn't a good place either because you're basically – that's the line you're taking.
Right.
So we knew something immediately was wrong.
And obviously you're racing, but the racing goes out the window when you know somebody is seriously injured. The clock goes away, and it's like, where is this person, and how can we help?
Oh, yeah. The race is over. I mean, like, so it wasn't, and it wasn't ever even a thought. I mean, there was no consideration of, like, can I get this taken care of in 5 minutes to get like a flat tire? This is like immediately, we know that there's somebody over this rock wall. There's a ledge there, and we peeked over the ledge, and it looked a little spicy. And so we basically started, it took us a few minutes to really kind of peek down and locate. What we thought was really trash in the beginning, it was like these little like red and white specks down, you know, several feet below. But then we realized there's no trash.
This is France, right?
So,
yeah.
Yeah, this is so we knew there was a person down there, so we immediately kind of hopped the wall and scaled down the mountain and found a guy down there unconscious and reached a really bad leg injury. And doing what you would do. I think the average person, without a medical background, I speak for myself, but just started screaming
for
like
help,
a schoolgirl, for help. Right, exactly.
So you're in bike shoes. It's not like you've got something where you can actually traverse anything, and you had to drop 15 feet or so to get to the next thing. And so, I mean, you sort of put yourself in a bad position because there really wasn't any other way to get down to that person besides putting yourself at risk.
Well, there was a different way to get down, and that was the helicopters.
Yeah,
but we didn't have that.
No.
But no, yeah, we got down there, and, I'll say it wasn't as bad as it sounded. Like, 15 feet's bad, but, we kind of hoisted ourselves over the ledge and hung
right
from it. So that lessened the amount of the fall. But then, from there, it was another 50 feet or so down to where
yes.
he was. And we didn't even still know as a person until we got to within maybe 5 feet of him, and then we were just... It was like, wow, then, you go from your heart, your adrenaline's already pumping, and then your heart rate immediately goes up because you see this person in need. So it was like, how can we help?
And the femur is sticking through the skin. So obviously
this person... The femur's out, broken in half,
Oh, and was he awake?
He was unconscious. Over, the course of like maybe 10 or 15 minutes, we just tried, we took his vitals, his breathing looked okay. Wasn't struggling to breathe, and we just, you kind of did the little kind of slap on the cheek, to kind of get him to see if he could talk to us, and he did a few times. We just tried to keep him, in consciousness, making sure he was okay, and he spoke good enough English to where he could, he was definitely in shock and knocked unconscious or whatever, but it was relieving to us that, he was breathing and he was able to talk to us.
Well, and it sounds like there was like the one bush that he was on. If it wasn't for that bush, he would have just kept going.
Oh, yeah, Bob. He must have flown like Superman over this cliff. Like it is, one of the things I did after we got everything stabilized and the medics came down is I stopped my Garmin watch and I said, I've got to memorialize this spot so I can look at it on Google Maps.
Right.
Just because I can't even believe I'm down here. And what would happen was it was this big rock scree, this field of rocks of different sizes. But then there's like this one big lone bush like there. And it's in the middle of nowhere. And he's like jammed right in the middle of that bush. He just kind of tumbled down and fell in this bush. But like 5 or 10 feet beyond that bush is just, another massive fall. And I didn't even go close enough to it because it looked like it was straight down, probably another 50 feet to the canyon floor. So had he not hit that bush,
he'd be dead.
I'm sure would have just kept tumbling. Yeah.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, it's a rock face straight down to the canyon. So, yeah, it would have totally been gone. So at that point, you've got a course medic passing by on motorcycle?
Yes. Yes. So she... I think, she saw our bikes.
Yeah.
Me and this other guy, Troy, which is, he actually got to the scene before I did, probably just in seconds because he was ahead of me. I remember seeing him on the switchback before this.
Yeah.
And, we set our bikes up against the edge of the rail. So she must have just seen three bikes there, two good ones, one smashed, and just automatically put two and two together that something's happening down there. So, so she stopped immediately as we're screaming. And, we basically signaled for her to come down, and she did. She kind of roped up and harnessed and kind of lowered herself down. So that was pretty quick, actually.
Yeah.
In a few minutes.
Well, yeah, but it took, 90 minutes to get him to – got to figure out how to get him. They have to use a helicopter to get him out of there?
Yeah, there's a couple of helicopters. One, the initial one came and dropped a medic down with all the gear. There was another guy that came down in ropes and harness, before the helicopter. And then the final takeaway was once a bunch of IVs had been run and, we're just trying to hold his head up.
Sure.
So he's not, after they put the neck brace on, we have to do that. But there was about an hour of holding his head in a position because he kept trying to turn around to see what was going on when he would come back into consciousness. And, we're just telling him, don't move your head. Don't move,
At that point, you're down there holding his head. And then... how long do you think you guys were there in total?
I'll tell you, it was, halfway through this, we knew he was going to be okay. You know, this was going to be a situation that was going to take care of itself. And then this is when they really basically said, okay, there's eight people down here. You guys are free to go. So that's when we went back to our bikes.
So you go back to your bikes, and obviously, at this point, have they closed the bike course?
Yeah, that's what we thought. You know, we got to the bikes, and we're like, well, we're just going to, first of all, I had zero, you know, we didn't want to push watts. It was just like, get on the brakes and get back down to the bottom of the hill.
Yeah.
You know, we believe they were just escorting us down the hill to get us to back to transition so we could then go, you know, let our loved ones know that we're okay. Because,
sure.
You know, all the bikes have been off the course except for R2. So, you know, our wives, both of them were on pins and needles. So we're coming back down the mountain with really, it just was the most amazing experience ever. Like heroes parade, like every police officer, every aid station.
Aid station, yeah.
Clapping and taking videos. And, you know, we didn't really kind of know what was happening until about halfway through. We're like, gosh, they must have told them through walkie-talkie that, you know, we were on top of the mountain and helped this guy. So
Wow. All
we really wanted to do at the time, we didn't really care about the race. We just wanted to get down and hug our wives.
Yeah, let everybody know you're okay.
We're okay.
Yeah. So
go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say that, and transitions and everything had been closed, and they're basically reopening just to take care of you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Transitions were closed, and we get down there and we see probably 1,000 people lining the streets for the bikes as we come in. And sure enough, they had opened transitions back for us. We went in, got our shoes, racked our bikes. We thought we were going to be racking our bikes and just be done with it.
Right.
Fine. But the Ironman organization is just, you know, I'll tell you, having done a lot of events, it's rare you get to go to an event where the organizers have everything so dialed in. And
right.
It's just like you're treated like a king. And there was no better way to describe what happened there, which was race directors coming out, having a conversation with us, thanking us for the help, letting us know that they're opening the course back up. They, you know, we both had time on the clock still anyway, even though we had missed the cutoff, we still had time underneath the 8-hour mark to finish. And that's what we did. I mean, our adrenaline was depleted and we were a little banged up, you know, but it was fairly easy to run considering, you know, we weren't injured like this guy, you know, we were hurt a little bit, but it wasn't anything comparatively.
Did you guys just run together?
We did. They'd asked us to kind of run together and told us that, you know, the race directors wanted to meet us at the finish line. So we just made the decision to hang together, gut it out, and finish together. So, yeah.
How fun is that? That is so cool. So coming across that, obviously you didn't have the time that you wanted, but coming across that finish line with the adventure that you had just had to be pretty special.
It was amazing. And I'll tell you, the first thing I thought of was coming across that finish line. I said, I'm going to have a great story to tell my friends. And it's
yeah, absolutely.
Not even about the rescue. It's not even about the rescue. It's about, I get to say I finished 506th out of 507th in my age group. I was actually kind of hoping it would have been dead last place. But for whatever reason, it wasn't. I don't know how it wasn't, because I'm pretty sure I was the last age group on the course of my age group. But it was a, you know, again, not, it wasn't about time. Like, I can't even imagine a scenario where I would have thought racing was more important than, you know, helping somebody. So it's, I wrote this in an article on my Facebook post. I basically said, listen, I didn't do anything different than I think everybody would have done.
Right.
I actually know that. I don't know. I'm not going to share any information about the gentleman that I helped, but I'll tell you, the irony of this whole thing was that I went and Googled this guy's name, and I'm not going to mention names, right?
Okay.
I went and Googled this guy's name, but the only article I could find online was from a previous Ironman World Championship that he had done. And the article talked about how he raced, and his race time was somewhat slow because he stopped and helped a downed biker that had been knocked unconscious and stayed there until he knew the biker was going to be okay.
Wow.
And it was just such an amazing, I got chills when I read this.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever read. And it happened at Ironman World Championship just a few years ago. And I was just like, wow, this is, it's pay it forward and be there for your brother. And that's, you know, I guess that's all we can do as human beings, is just be there for each other.
So I'm guessing that you, from the races I've done, when we've been in Kona and, you know, people you don't know beforehand, all of a sudden you're running that last 10 miles with him and you become buddies for life. I'm guessing that you've established a bond with the gentleman who helped you help our cyclist in need.
Yeah, Bob, it was amazing. When we were down there, I looked at his tri-kit when he was turned around, and the tri-kit said LaBerge Sedona, which is a resort in Sedona. I live in Arizona. And
no
I said, wait a minute. I said, where are you from? He said, Arizona.
Oh, my
God.
Thinking,
you know, we're in Nice, France. We're on the bottom of this mountain, on almost a canyon floor. We both got down here at this point of the race, at the exact same point. There can't be more than 10 or 15 people from Arizona in the whole race.
Right.
And you're both from Arizona. He lives literally 10 minutes from me. It was the most, you know, just the irony. I don't know how, you can't even, I don't think, write the story any better.
So any contact with the gentleman who was hurt, and is he okay now?
We heard from the race director.
Yes.
He's fine. I guess that injury, he's going to stay a few days in Nice.
Yes.
I guess it was a good thing he was kind of unconscious, because apparently that break, that femur, is that's a painful one.
Oh,
if
yeah.
you are not, if you're awake from that is not good. So, it was probably a good thing he was knocked unconscious, and then, they started all the IVs and everything and got him the pain medication he needed pretty quickly. But, I definitely want, I came back with, his sunglasses and an Iron Man worker's vest. I stuffed in the back of my tri-suit when the helicopters came, and it started blowing everything everywhere. So we're just, tucking things everywhere, so they don't blow down the mountain. So I've got some sunglasses to return to him. So I definitely want to, find a way to do that when he gets healed up.
So of all the racing you've done, when you look back at everything you've accomplished in racing, does this one stick out as, oh my God, of all the races I've done, this is the story that I will be sharing forever?
Sure. I mean, it definitely does. I mean, if I would have seen those bikes there and ridden by it and then heard this story later, I just don't know how I could live with myself. Right. So, and again, I'm certain that Troy and I were the first people on the scene. I know this is something that every single person would have done. So it is, it's definitely one for the books. I don't know how it gets topped. Other than, from an athletic standpoint, qualifying for Kona, that'll probably be pretty special too. But I don't think it tops this in terms of just how it makes you feel as a human being. I don't know that anything's going to top this.
So what's next?
Well, we've got Waco in a couple weeks, 5 weeks from now. Then we've got Ironman Arizona, which is the Ironman Arizona is the A race, and then I go February and I race 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days.
Oh, are you
charity.
Doing that? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm doing it. Yeah, yeah.
You will love it.
So it's going to be fun.
I've had a number of our friends, a number of our Challenge Athlete Foundation athletes have participated. That is a pretty special trip. You're going to love that.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, Rick, thanks so much for taking so much time. Congratulations on really having an epic race and doing something that all of us hopefully would do the same exact thing. The race goes out the window. The clock goes out the window. It's all about helping your fellow triathlete who's obviously in need. And the part that amazes me is that this gentleman helped somebody else in a different race, because it certainly is payback.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was definitely an honor to do your show, Bob. I really appreciate the chance, and thank you very much.
Love it. Rick Steele has been our guest again. My name is Bob Babbitt. This is Babbittville Radio. We are brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar. Winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We just sent out 3,260 grants, totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org and check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here.